God, I'm satisfied. Well, I'm headless now. Well, I'm glad I know I'm home so. Well, I was crucified. God, I'm satisfied. God, I'm satisfied. God, I'm a well, I'm glad to know that it's.
Hey, everybody, Gregory Conley here with another edition of the Your Video Store Shelf podcast here at yourvideostoreshelf.com. Joining us on today's show is a veteran director, producer, and editor of such films as The Dead Next Door, Ozone, and Witch House 2 and 3, and he has worked with the likes of Charlie Band, David Dakota, and even Sam Raimi. And now he is on our show to promote the release of his company's Bad Movie Police Crime Wave 5-pack, which includes five movies that he was a part of in his younger, less informed years. J.R. Bookwalter, how you doing?
Good. How about you, Greg?
I'm doing very well. Glad to see that we were able to do this interview.
Yeah, no problem.
So, tell us about the Bad Movie Police 5-pack. It's a concept that you've had around for a few years now, and now you're just combining the five that you've already done, I assume?
Well, what it is, it actually predates the original releases by probably a few years. I think it goes back to somewhere where I was sort of knee-deep in the middle of the Full Moon era is when I first came up with the idea, and I had done these. There were six movies. They were shot on Super VHS for Cinema Home Video back in the 1991, 92. And basically there were five of them that I just felt like, you know, you can't release these on their own and be taken too seriously. So that's kind of where the concept came from. And it was a running joke amongst all my friends and I every time we'd hear a police siren. We'd be like, oh, we got to run, the Bad Movie Police are coming to get us or whatever. So that's kind of where it started. And I think originally we were going to do it, I'm trying to remember what year it was. It must have been the end of 2000 maybe, I think is when I first was seriously thinking about doing it. And at the time it was just Ariana Albright who was going to play her character and like a couple guys with her in the task force. And we got some scripts written, and it just wasn't going the direction that I thought, and I got busy with other stuff, so I kind of let it slide, I think, until, I think it was 2003. It was maybe 3 years past before I kind of revisited it. And what really prompted it was I was kind of done with Full Moon, and I had successfully managed to launch Tempe DVD, and that was kind of the idea to, well, let's shoot these, you know, shoot these script and shoot these little segments, to go along with me. So we kind of just did one long weekend, did the wraparounds for the first three, and then I released the first two, I think, the end of that year. It was like October of 2003. That's kind of where I launched the series, and then it was another year before I got the third one finished and out. And then there were still two movies kind of sitting around, and they just sat so long that I felt like, well, maybe I'll just do these as a double feature, and then it'll make a nice little five-pack. So that's kind of, long story short, that's kind of how it came to be.
So explain, if you wouldn't mind, the story behind Cinema Home Video and how these films came to be.
I had done some previous movies for Cinema Home Video that were done on 16mm, and they basically had gotten a chunk of money from some foreign deal or something and decided to come home video distributors. And, of course, this is back in HS. We're talking about the late 80s. And we had done that, and then kind of business dried up, and Dave Dakota went back to, who was the head of Cinema Home Video, went back to producing movies for Charlie Band, ironically, so I don't know why Full Moon seems to circle around all these stories, but I was living in L.A. I'd lived in L.A. for about a year and a half. This was the first time I moved out there, and I was going to move back, and my idea was, I was going to move back to Ohio, sorry, I should specify, and I was going to make some movies on video because I just felt like that was the right move to make at the time. And this is, of course, before that was popular. Now everybody does it. But he kind of caught wind of that and said, oh, well, you know what? I've got a deal with this company called Rentrack out of Portland, Oregon. And they'll pay like 10 bucks a unit up front. And then there's all this revenue sharing, and maybe we can make some small movies. And and you know, and I can make some quick money. So basically what we did is the first two were Zombie Cop and Kingdom of the Vampire, and it was two movies for $5,000 that finished.
Jeez.
And yeah, and then the biggest problem with it was we had to do it in such a tight amount of time. I mean, we were literally, he needed the box art well before everything else. So we were literally like coming up with artwork, and I was putting a box together before we ever shot or let alone cast or really even scripted the movie. He needed the artwork to go to the printers because he was sending this artwork and using that to get it listed in the RentTrak catalog, and then it would take maybe 8 weeks or 10 weeks or something before he'd actually have to ship orders, and that 8 or 10 weeks is where we were finishing the movies, or doing the movie, period. So it was kind of funny because, you know, we really didn't know who was going to be in any of these movies, so he couldn't put any names on the box as far as who stars in it, and we didn't even know if the description of the movie, you know, there was a video box synopsis on the back. We didn't even know if that was how the movie was actually going to turn. You know, it could take a complete different detour, you know, plot-wise. So, anyways, the grand scheme of this, that whole crazy scheme that he had was he was thinking about doing 12 of these in a year, in the space of a year. And basically it broke down like this. It was going to be a week to write them, a week to shoot them, a week to edit them, and a week to do the post-production, and then repeat for 1 year straight. And I was dumb enough at the time to almost think that sounded like a good idea, because I had just come off of, any time that I made some movies and then there was kind of a drought period, you know, I think most filmmakers can understand this. They're sort of like, oh, I'll just do anything. I'll do anything. I've got to make a movie. Got to make a movie. Fortunately, now I'm 40 years old, and I'm a lot older and wiser now. I would never do that again. But anyways, what it wound up being was the six-pack of movies that was done over 7 months. And the budgets, you know, it was, the first two were $5,000 for two movies. The second two were $5,000 for two movies, which was Chick Boxer and Maximum Impact. And then the final set of two movies were done for two movies for $2,500.
What?
It was cut in half. And that was Galaxy of the Dinosaurs and Humanoids from Atlantis. And basically by the end of the six movies in 7 months, I think we all wanted to slit our throats. And I know for me personally, that was the first time I was ready to just go, maybe this isn't what I was destined to do. Maybe I should go get a, you know, job as a stockbroker or something.
Seriously, but the goofy kids with DV cameras barely even do two movies for $5,000 these days. They don't.
Yeah, and I mean, back then we're talking about Super VHS, and, you know, it was just, they were different days, and we, you know, certainly didn't have any kind of sophisticated editing stuff. I had, you know, a couple of Super VHS decks and an Amiga or Amiga computer that we were triggering sound effects from, and this was so dinosaur, low-tech way of doing things, and slow way of doing things, but we made every one of those deadlines. The only real concession to making these very tight deadlines was, I think, Humanoids from Atlantis was shot, Galaxy of the Dinosaurs was shot end of February, and then we had to, of that year, and we had to shoot Humanoids from Atlantis in March of that year, and of course it's Ohio. The whole story is about this sea creature guy that lives in the nearby lake or whatever ridiculousness it was, and, you know, it's snowing one day and freezing cold, and, you know, you can't put anybody in the lake. So anyways, the movie wound up, because of the deadline, literally got it cut down, where I think we shot maybe 10 or 15 minutes of what was in the script, and then the other half hour that wound up, you know, that we made, the whole movie was like 45 minutes, which, you know, was like the biggest crime in cinema history, because the box, of course, which had been done already, said 75 minutes and said a much better story that wasn't actually in the movie. So it was an experience. I can't say it's an experience I'd want to relive, but yeah, somehow through fate over the years, I wound up with these, you know, and buying them back from Cinema Home Video, and that's kind of what I said. Well, I'm going to, you know, most people would just stick these in their closet and forget about them. I think, you know, it's more fun to drag them out and make fun of them, you know, before anybody else has a chance to, or make it where people have, you know, where it's like, aha, wink, wink, nod, nod, you know, we did these crappy movies, and we're making fun of them, and you can too, kind of a thing, so.
I love the fact that some of these old home video releases that you can't really find anywhere are getting unearthed nowadays.
Yeah, I mean, especially for me, this I wanted to kind of, there's a few loose titles left that I wanted to kind of get out and clear. I'm trying to clean out the closet so I can just say all the old stuff's on DVD. It's taken me a lot longer to get around to remastering a lot of the stuff and putting it out than I'm not even just the Bad Movie Police films, but it's just, you know, this has been going on for, I think, 5 years or 6 years now that it's taken me to get all these movies out in between, you know, of course, acquiring other movies from other filmmakers. And so sometimes it takes longer than you think it's going to.
Of the five titles that are in the Bad Movie Police 5-pack, what would you say is the most absurd?
The most absurd?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, certainly the worst two offenders have got to be Humanoids from Atlantis, because it's really an unfinished movie, and Chick Boxer. So the second and third ones are kind of like, you know, the other three, there's a movie where it's like maybe it could be a real movie with a little more time and effort put into it. Those two I don't think anybody would ever mistake for real movies.
And what was unfortunate for you was that before you had done the Cinema Home Video movies, you had directed and produced a film that a lot of people liked at the time called Dead Next Door. But unfortunately, the film had yet to come out. So even though magazines had written about Dead Next Door, your first reviews were for these movies, which people tore apart.
Actually, Robot Ninja was the second movie I made, and that was actually the first one that was released. And yeah, and it was savage. I mean, it was just like savage, like a horrible, you know. And it's not a very good movie. I think it was Scott Spiegel who was actually got a cameo in it, was the one that said, "Oh, you should just tell everybody that Robot Ninja was made first and Dead Next Door was made second, because you know, so people will like that one better."
You learned from your mistakes.
No, not really, but it's kind of to me, it's like truth in advertising, and it's the same thing with behind the Bad Movie Police idea. It's just sort of like, you know, yeah, we know it's bad. If you like that kind of thing, here it is, you know. So, but no, I mean, yeah, I obviously we worked 4 years on Dead Next Door, and that was well before any of this stuff. And kind of what happened was I was locked away for so long working on that movie, and it just was such a long, grueling process that by the time it was finished, I just wanted to get away from it and make anything else, you know, because I felt creatively sort of chained to that movie for so long. And that's not always a good thing. I like to say I don't regret anything I've done, but at least I try to, you know, release my regrets and, I don't know, it's some sort of bizarre therapy for me, I guess.
And Dead Next Door is out on a special edition from Anchor Bay.
Yeah, that came out almost 2 years ago, yeah.
Yeah, and that's a film that you said in an interview that I was reading that you've been asked this story so many times that you're tired of telling it, but I've got to ask again. How did Dead Next Door come about?
I guess the short version of it is that I found out about Evil Dead 2 was in early pre-production in Detroit, Michigan, and I had dropped out of college coming through old back issues for you, and I thought, well, you know, I'm going to go to Detroit. They're only in Detroit. It's like a four-hour drive from Akron, Ohio. Drive up there and see if I can get a job. Well, long story short, instead of a job on Evil Dead 2, I wound up making my own feature film out of it, which was definitely not my idea going in, but I was encouraged to do it by the powers that be, and the rest is, I don't know, some sort of bizarre history, I guess.
Yeah, and that powers to be, of course, included the great Sam Raimi, who I believe the story was that he had a contract with Universal, so he had to use a pseudonym for the film.
You know, I think that kind of became part of the legend. I don't really remember all the details, but I know at the time it wasn't just Dead Next Door that was being made. He had another film that he was producing called Easy Wheels. I think it was some comedy thing, and there may have been some other stuff in there that I'm not even aware of, and his name's not on any of those projects. So I believe at the time, I don't know if it was Universal saying that they didn't want him to put his name on anything else, or his choice to just sort of, you know, keep his name clean. And, you know, I honestly don't remember, because it was just too many years and just too old now.
So your career is kind of been split into a few different pieces, where you worked for David making the movies that are in the Bad Movie Police series, And then after that, you went off, and I believe you made some films with John Russo?
I did, yeah. That was kind of in 92, 93, somewhere in there. I did a documentary on Night of the Living Dead and produced Midnight 2 for him. And also, you know, at the time, my Tempe Video label had released Heartstopper and the Majorettes through that label. And, yeah, that was a couple-year period there where we did some stuff together.
Yeah, and how did Tempe Video come to be? Was it just you saw Cinema Home Video and said, "I bet I can do this. I can do this better."
Well, yeah, it was mostly from just frustration because I felt like Cinema Home Video was doing was not the direction, not the choices that I would have made. So it was, you know, they were just doing it just to get stuff out there and make some quick bucks. And I felt like, you know, gee, you know, if you spend a little and a little more effort on these movies, you don't even necessarily have to have a little bit more money, because there's a lot of things you can do, you know, without money, certainly if you have, you know, if you're resourceful enough. So it kind of that, and that's when after I was sort of creatively bankrupt with Humanoids for Atlantis, I decided I'm not going to do anything else, and then the script for this movie Ozone fell on my lap, and that was kind of what reinvigorated me to get back into it again. And that movie, which was made for about $3,500, that was sort of like making the point of how I felt coming off of the Cinema Home Video era. Like, okay, here's a movie where we didn't have any more money, but we had a little bit more time and we put a little more effort and care and to try and, you know, show people that yes, this can be done. And at the time it apparently, from what I'd told, was fairly inspirational to that generation of filmmakers. There's a lot of folks that went off and said, hey, we want to do this too, kind of thing. So
when you're making a movie for $3,500, is the most difficult part of making your money back just simply the fact that you have to run a company?
Well, yeah, for me, I've made the bulk of my movies in my so-called career. I've done them for other people, you know, as work for hire. And that's a very different thing than being an auteur and just saying, well, we're going to make this movie and we're going to spend all the time we want on it and we're going to finish it the way we want and then we're going to sell it or try to find somebody to sell it. You know, it's a very different mentality. You have to be beholden to whoever gives you the money and blah, blah, blah. So when I started Tempe Video and then even Tempe DVD later, the philosophy behind it was I want to control the whole ball of wax. I don't, you know, because I've gotten screwed by distributors, not as bad as certainly a lot of people have, but I've gotten, you know, I've had that experience where it's like you feel like you're helpless, you know, like watching them promote your movie a certain way or watching them do things that you don't think they should do or just, you know, pull not pay from it. So to me, it was like there was no other option. I'm too much of a do-it-yourselfer, and I felt like, I want to control the whole thing.
And what would you say, I'm kind of interested in this, was the most ridiculous way that one of your movies has been promoted?
Well, I got to go back to the one that I always come up with was my second film, Robot Ninja, which was very, like, dark sort of revenge thing. You know, it's kind of a silly movie, but it's not intentionally silly. Like, the theme of the movie is very dark, and they had somebody cut this ridiculous trailer that actually had Gary Owens, the guy who used to do the laugh-in voiceovers or whatever, do the narration, and they literally, the trailer is portrayed as a comedy, and it actually works pretty well like that, but that wasn't the intention. I just felt like, man, oh man, this is just not the direction at all that I would have, because, you know, it's funny too, because the way they packaged the movie certainly didn't fit with that trailer, but that was really my first experience where something like that was taken completely out of my hands. And that was one of the first, the earliest memories I have of looking at something going, now this is definitely not the right way to do this.
And, you know, I have to admit, you guys came up with some pretty damn good titles.
Oh, well, thank you. I mean, I can't say where I was always responsible for every one of them, but.
So, moving on, when did you jump on the digital video bandwagon?
Well, we were pretty much there. I've sort of been credited with the film Polymorph that we shot in '96 as being like the first guy to shoot a feature on the DX, what was it, DX1000, DVX1000, whatever the first Sony 3-chip camera was. I guess we were, because I no It was 2 years later before he started to see a whole slew of people shooting on that camera, but that was the summer of 96 with Polymorph. That was probably the very first one that we did that way.
And soon enough, was it before or after Polymorph that you got hooked up with Charlie Band?
That was another, I guess, let me see, 96. It was maybe another year and a half. And that actually came about through Dave Dakota, who was making a movie called Shrieker for Full Moon at the time. I think he's credited as Victoria Sloan or one of his numerous pseudonyms on that movie. But he came to me and he saw me doing some post-production work for some friends of mine film. This is shortly after I moved to Los Angeles in my living room of all places. And he said, hey, how would you like to edit and do the sound mix for this thing? And I thought, well, sure, why not? It's a 35mm show. They're shooting it, you know, 2.35 anamorphic and, you know, that would be cool. I can. The thing was, a lot of people always looked down or frowned upon the way I was finishing these movies, even though I felt like I had there was a certain amount of talent in the post production department. We were doing it with no budget movies that were shot on video or camcorders, and nobody was really taking it seriously. So Shrieker was kind of the first time that I actually cut. I can't call it a real movie, but it looked like a real movie, and it impressed a lot of people, including Charlie Band, and that was kind of the, you know, next thing I know, I was cutting Curse of the Puppet Master, and then a few months went by, and we were working nonstop for them, and it kind of built up to the point where they fired their post-production supervisor and hired me, and I brought in a bunch of people, and next thing I know, I'm managing like 20 people and have an eighth-floor office downtown at Hollywood and Vine, and making a lot more money than I ever had doing anything else. At least for a short period of time.
Nice. And how long did you, actually, now that I actually know the answer to that, at what point did being the post-production man for Full Moon morph into being a production guy?
Well, let's see, I think I started, it was the end of 97 when I cut Shrieker, the fall of 97, I guess, and I think it was the end of 99, so it was about 2 years, you know, it was 2 years. I developed a couple things for them when I was, you know, playing the post guy. There was a thing that they were going to do. They did this Film Monster series where they had, I guess, two of these things shot. It was A Werewolf Reborn, which Jeff Burr did, and Frankenstein Reborn. And they were both shot in Romania. And they were kind of like 45, 50-minute short horror films for teenagers, I guess. And they were going to do, like, I think three more of these things. And he's like, well, you know, if you come and work for us in the post department, you can direct one of these. Which one do you want to do? And I was like, well, I always like mummy movies. I'll do the Mummy Airborne. So I actually got a script written and developed, and it just the series, I think financially it didn't work out for them. So that never happened. And then I was writing with Scott Phillips, who was working for me at the time, who would later go on to do a film called The Stink of Flesh. He wrote a script for me called Fear.com, which would later become HorrorVision.com, which actually did get made, but I didn't direct it. So there was stuff being developed while I was doing the post stuff, but it was really when I got hired. I actually went to a meeting thinking I was going to be making HorrorVision.com and instead got offered Witch House 2, and that's kind of how that happened.
And after Witch House 2, you guys, Tempe, you were pretty much Full Moon's production studio during a time where the company started to take their budgets from the $2 million range and bring it down and down and down.
Well, they kind of had already made that leap because by the time I started working for them, Anchor was made for maybe $125,000-$150,000 at a time where things prior to that, like The Creeps and Hideous, were being done for, you know, $500,000 or something like that. So they had already kind of fell in budget range, but certainly not as far as we came down. And basically that came about because Charlie was thrilled with everything that happened with Witch House 2. I don't think he knew what to expect, but here I went off to Romania and made this movie, and we had a couple of firsts on that movie because we were the first people to do an anamorphic, you know, widescreen transfer for the DVD release, and we were the first people to you know, I pushed for that, and I pushed for a 5.1, you know, surround mix, and I think he saw all this effort and just thought, well, geez, you know, we've been using this guy just for post, why don't we just have him bang out a bunch of movies for us. So it's kind of mirrored what happened with Cinema Home Video a decade earlier or whatever, because it became like, oh, this guy's pretty resourceful, let's take advantage of it. And I don't know when to say no, so at the time it's pretty good. It was going to be fun. I think it was the summer of summer of 2000 that we made this deal, and it was going to be four features that would be shot on DV cam, you know, which is a higher DV format. And we were going to shoot them anamorphic, mix them 5.1, you know, all the same way, but the average budget was going to be $50,000, and we were going to shoot them in L.A. And one of those wound up going much, you know, having a much bigger budget and a lot more work put into it, which was the William Shatner debacle group, which nearly put Charlie Band out of business at that point. But that's another story for another day.
Can that day be today?
Yeah, I suppose if you want. I'm saving some of those for my memoir, some of those stories. But, yeah, what do you want to know?
tell me anything about Groom Lake, because I have heard nothing about it.
Well, I mean, it was a friggin' nightmare. I mean, that's the main thing about it. Basically what we did is we were making our vision, and then that kind of, at the same time we were prepping the next movie, which was called Stitches, and prepping the movie after that, which was The Vault. Well, I think by the time we were wrapping Horror Vision and starting the post, that's when I was approached to produce Groom Lake, which would be the fourth of these. Originally, there was supposed to be four movies that were a lot more manageable, you know, and I'd say manageable budget-wise and production, you know, like I had pretty much control over the hiring the directors and blah, 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 blah. Well, Groom Lake was a different story because here was William Shatner coming to Full Moon with his own script, and he wanted to direct, and then he'd co-star in the movie. And, of course, by him being in it means that it has to be a Screen Actors Guild signatory movie, which makes the budget go up. And by him directing means we have to hire assistant directors from the Directors Guild of America. And the screenwriter was the Writers Guild of America. So suddenly now you got all these guilds involved. Well, when you get involved the guilds, the budget goes up. It has to. Because, you know, the Screen Actors Guild wants you to post like a $10,000 or $15,000 bond to make sure everybody gets paid, and it's contingent on what the budget is. Anyway, long story short, William Shatner was shooting for the moon. Charlie Band the whole time was whispering in my ear, you know, do it for cheap, do it for cheap, do it for cheap. So, you know, I've got Charlie who's telling Shatner that it's a $500,000 movie, and then he's going to me going, that's a $125,000 movie. So, it was, needless to say, that wasn't an easy task to do. And, of course, at the time, he was also making a deal with Shatner to do this Full Moon Fright Night thing that was for Sci-Fi Channel, which is basically a way to recycle some of his catalog of movies with Shatner hosting them, which actually did wind up happening. But I remember specifically one day, and we shot Groom Lake all on location in Arizona, in Tucson and Bisbee, Arizona, and we were in the middle of nowhere. I mean, we were literally like right at the Mexican border in this small border town. Shooting, and I'm on the phone trying to haggle with Shatner in the room, trying to negotiate. They're negotiating over, like, Shatner wants another helicopter for another day to shoot helicopter shots or some ridiculousness. He wants something for the movie, and he's negotiating with Charlie over this Fright Night thing, which has nothing to do with me, to try and get what he wants on this movie. And that's kind of the absurdity of the whole movie. So, needless to say, he got what he wanted, and financially, it was just a disaster. So.
What do you think you probably know this. Well, what did the budget of $125,000 balloon to?
I think by my estimates, it was over $1 million by the time it was done.
Oh, my God.
Is really, I mean, and a good chunk of that went to Shatner's attorneys, because everything we did, Shatner's attorneys had to sign off on it. So they were, you know, they were billable hours being clocked in. And he took it, you know, he ultimately wound up taking it out of our hands once the thing was, I think we did a first cut, and then he took it out of our hands and took it to really expensive post-production facilities who didn't do a very good job, but, of course, you know, got him to write a lot of checks. So that, you know, most of those costs were well after, you know, my involvement in the movie, but I think we were easily spending $300,000-$400,000 by the time that, you know, just to get the thing in the can.
And I have never seen that in a single video store, so I guess it really was a bomb.
Well, what happened, it came out actually, I think it was January, let me think of the year here. It came out in January of whatever year that was. I think it was 2002, maybe. It must have been, because I think it sat around for 2 years or so after it was shot. And it was Charlie, Shatner took it back to Charlie after taking over the movie and let him do a limited release. Like, I think he had the rights for 6 months. He sold it to Blockbuster and Hollywood Video, and they didn't take a lot of units. In fact, at the time, I had a side deal with Charlie to re-release my film Ozone under a new title called Street Zombies to get it into Blockbuster and Hollywood Video, and I actually shipped more units of Street Zombies, a.k.a. Ozone, than they did of Groom Lake. And we both, you know, we got the same amount of money so per unit, so you do the math. My movie cost $3,500, his movie cost over $1 million, so...
And that's kind of how the economics worked for the other films you produced for Charlie Band, where it was, we can do these as cheap as possible and ship out as many units as possible. And I think in the end, I don't think that was able to save Full Moon, at least for the time being.
Well, it would have, because there were some of those movies, like Killjoke 2, which is not exactly high point in my career, but it shipped enough units that any other company would have been able to survive for quite a while on that. I think at the time, the figure I was told was $300,000 or $400,000 that movie made, and it cost under $30,000. So you tell me, you know, it's like Charlie runs around demeaning these movies now, you know, 4 years later. But the reality is, he should have been able to run his company, because at that point, you know, he had really downsized tremendously. He didn't have the post-production department anymore. We were gone, and we were doing stuff independently, and the movies weren't costing much. It was kind of an all-in deal where we did the production and the post, every, you know, for one price. And, you know, he likes to live a lavish lifestyle, what can I say?
So yeah, I was
money,
actually...
The money definitely didn't go towards the overhead so much.
I was talking to a prop lady a long time ago, and she was talking about how she was at the Full Moon office in probably 92 or 93, and Charlie's Porsche was taken away.
Oh, yeah. There's a million of those kind of stories. I can't tell you how many times the sheriff showed up at the office when I was working for him. And, I mean, there's just, you could go on and on. It's just, he just, I don't know what it is. The guy's always behind the curve because he's living life like a Hollywood mogul, but he's not quite a Hollywood mogul, I guess. That's the best way of putting it.
But he's making Killjoy, too.
That's right.
The Killjoy movies always drove me nuts because I love the idea of a killer clown, yet two movies, and they are both... Killjoy 2 is a hell of a lot more watchable than the first one, I'll give it that.
Well, that's what I felt about it, but it's still not a good movie. I mean, when I was hired to make that, because that was kind of like we were going to do the same thing, we were making four movies again, and Killjoy 2 had to be part of the deal, and I was just sort of like, eh. You know, I felt like I did when Cinema Home Video said, you know, I have to make Chick Boxer. It's like, what? You know, come on. So we did it, and, you know, our goal was, okay, it's got to be better than the first one, right? Like, the first one wasn't very well regarded, but it shipped a lot of units, and it rented well, and I don't know if anybody liked it, but, you know, Full Moon tends to do that. Like, they shipped a lot of units of the first Witch House when Blair Witch had just come out, and everybody was like, witch mania. And so then they want to make a second one and a third one, and it's always the law of diminishing returns. The sequels in the home video market never do as good as the original, because the original was a fluke. You know, it was tied to some other thing that who knows what it was. But so again, Witch House 2 and 3, in my opinion, are better movies than the first Witch House. Killjoy 2 might have been better than the first Killjoy, but it doesn't, you know, who cares, because not as many people are renting it at that point.
And so after you split off from Charlie Band, what have you been doing the past 3-4 years?
Mostly just really doing the distribution thing. I mean, right out of the gate, the last thing I had done for Charlie was another film I directed called Deadly Singers, which still hasn't seen the light of day. It was something for Fox Home Video, and who knows why it hasn't come out yet. But after that experience, that was when I knew I had to just move on. And I already had Tempe DVD kind of started, because I had gotten... I was actually owed money from producing Groom Lake and parlayed that debt into the deal to get the DVD rights to some of the movies that I produced for him, which mainly Witch House 3, Hell, and Dead and Rotting. So that's kind of how I launched my own DVD thing. I turned around and took those movies. And then I think pretty much right on the heels of finishing Stingers, you know, we shot those first three Bad Movie Police things, because I had signed a deal with Ventura Distribution at the time, which is now defunct. But they had, you know, promised the moon, and of course didn't deliver, but we got a bunch of releases out through them, I think, over the course of a couple years, and then I jumped to other distributors, and eventually, you know, last year I finally came full circle, and now I'm just kind of dealing direct with all my distribution entities, the people that I sell to. And, you know, the distribution business isn't any easier than producing movies for other people or getting out there and making stuff. But it's was kind of like after doing, I think it was 13 movies or something in 2.5 years for Charlie, I was ready to just do something that was a little slower paced. And that's where the DVD thing came in. I mean, originally it was started so that I could, you know, sort of feed my own machine. It's like, okay, I'm going to get my own movies made and, you know, I'll make my own movies or whatever and then I'll have the engine to release them. But it never quite works out that way because it's a little more time consuming to run a business than, you know, going on making movies. I watched it happen with Charlie Band at Full Moon. Every time he would go out and make a movie, you know, the entire company would almost grind to a halt and be, you know, bankrupt because he would spend so much money, you know, making his movies, but he expected you to take two dimes and a nickel and make something equally as good. So, yeah, that's pretty much it. I really just been doing the distribution thing, and in some weird way I've been focusing less on my whatever place I might have in the business and focusing more on family and life. And, you know, I left L.A. last year and moved back to Ohio and kind of wanted to settle down and make roots here and got married and, you know, just going to start a family and all that kind of stuff. And that's really been, I mean, I'm still doing the business stuff, but I'm not maybe as out there as I used to be, I suppose.
And I noticed that when I called up Tempe Video for the interview, you answered the phone. So are you running that company all by your lonesome self?
Pretty much these days it's a one-man band because, you know, the thing is, for years I've had, even before I was working for Charlie, I was working from my home or, you know, where I would have small offices or whatever. And you don't really have to do that anymore. I mean, the technology is kind of, you know, where you can have a few computers and maybe you get some people to come in now and again. And, you know, I had interns working for me in L.A. But even when we were doing the stuff for Charlie, we had access to his offices, but I was doing most of the stuff out of my apartment building. We had a couple of apartments in my building, and it's just much better for me to work that way. I like rolling out of bed in the morning and just going to work and not having to, you know, I telecommute because I, you know, I speak to the world through email or whatever. Nowadays, the reason I wouldn't have a secretary or even an intern around here is because I literally, most of my business is all through email or fax. It's, you know, I don't do a lot of phone conversations. I don't need to. You don't have to talk to anybody on the phone. We can sell DVDs to Netflix or our other distributors, you know, without ever having to make a phone call. So that's kind of the reason, I guess.
And what's coming up from Tempe?
Release-wise? Well, I'm actually in a midstream of transitioning back into doing some original production, maybe not me myself, we'll see if that happens, but I've got some of the guys that have been making movies for me over the years out doing some stuff for me, and some new guys too. At the end of last year, I released a film called My Dead Girlfriend that Brett Kelly did, and Brett had done the two Bonesetter films and The Feral Man, which I had released, and
Brett's a great guy.
Yeah, Brett's a great guy. And last year he shot a remake of Kingdom of the Vampire, which was kind of that sixth movie in that Cinema Home Video set that I decided not to give the Bad Movie Police treatment to. So I think by the end of the year we're going to release his version of Kingdom of the Vampire and a double feature with my original version from 91. So that's coming up. And I got a very funny, it's kind of a half sci-fi comedy and half documentary called Beer Drinkers in Space that's coming out in July, and so far that we're getting a lot of feedback from that one. That one looks, I mean, I kind of branched out in different areas to answer the question much more directly, because we're not just doing strictly horror, we're doing some comedy and some, you know, some different stuff, and I'm thinking about doing a short film collection where I take all the old short films from all the filmmakers that have been on the different labels that I've done and put it together in a box set, you know, with some extras and stuff. So we're thinking about doing that, and finally releasing at the end of August, which was technically my first video release back in 1987 when I attempted to play distributor at this thing called Basic How-To Halloween Makeups, which just shows kids how to do Halloween makeups. And some of our makeup artists actually show, you know, in the video. And you know, other than that, I think next year is going to be mostly original productions and less acquiring stuff. There's a lot of movies out there, and I got boxes of screeners that people have sent me here, and it's just too arduous to dig through and find anything good in all those movies. Mm-hmm. So I'm really backpedaling from that, and I want to get back into where, you know, we're paying for the movie and we're kind of controlling the production values at least a little bit better. So
very cool.
Next year should be a good year, I hope.
Okay. So let's get the plugs out there for the Tempe Video website and the MySpace.
MySpace, I've got a few pages set up there. One, of course, for me, and Tempe Video's got a page. Bad Movie Police has a page. Dead Next Door has a page now. The Sandman has a page. I don't want to do 85 pages because it's kind of ridiculous, but the main hub is tempevideo.com. I mean, that'll get you kind of everywhere else. We've got a online store there to buy the stuff. We're pretty much, as far as the internet goes, we're all over the place. I mean, you can go to deepdiscount.com, you can go to barnesandnobles.com, circuitcity.com, bestbuy.com. I mean, it's harder to find a website where we are not selling our DVDs than it is to find us. So that's the point.
And you can pick up the Bad Movie Police Crime Wave 5-pack for well under $20. So there's no excuse not to pop those in and have a good time. JR, thank you for doing the show.
No, my pleasure. Absolutely.
And so everybody check out the Bad Movie Police 5-pack along with any of JR's past films. And check out tempevideo.com. JR, thanks again. We will talk to you again soon.
Thanks a lot, Greg.
Thanks. And this is Greg Conley with the Your Video Store Shelf Podcast. Thanks for listening.
Up on the mountain trail, got a one that's sad and lone. And while my savior found me, while he claimed me for his own, placed his arms upon me, and he drove me to his